Okay, everyone hearing me okay? They're good? All right. Well, first of all, I want to thank the Show Me Institute and National Review Institute for bringing me out here. I also want to thank all of you for coming here. I think it was Will Rogers who said I wasn't born in Texas, but I got here as soon as I could. I feel that way about Kansas City, and I kind of feel like I know there's been a little bit of attention in this town. You know, a couple of Super Bowls will do that for you. I begrudgingly admit, as a New York Jets fan, you guys have the best quarterback in the league. And on top of all that, your team's tight end, there's this young woman who's got a bit of a music career going on, and apparently that's a big deal. Apparently, you know, I know this because they stopped covering football when the Chiefs covered the Jets and everything was about Taylor Swift. Nothing, there's anything wrong with that. Also, I'm going to start out with my most controversial point. Sauce Gardner did not commit defensive holding at the end of the Jets-Chiefs game. I'm just telling you that. I will take that to my grave. So. Anyway, as you can tell, I like to make people laugh, and I will try to do that where I can tonight, but when you're talking about Ukraine, it's not a lot of laughs. The title of my appearance is The State of the Conflict in Ukraine, and I'll put the headline up top. It's bad. The Ukrainians have fought like hellions for about a bit more than 2 years. They began the war outmanned and outgunned by the Russians, and they've managed to hang on by being smarter and using what they've got more effectively. Their ingenuity would impress MacGyver. They're actually winning the war in the Black Sea, which is really impressive because Ukraine doesn't have a navy. They had one submarine at the beginning of the war that they sank so that the Russians couldn't shoot it down at the beginning of the war. Everything they've done has been with drones and long-range missiles and things like that, and they've managed to sink a whole bunch of Russian naval vessels. Even if the United States had not decided to take about a six-month break from resupplying them with weapons and ammunition, Vladimir Putin and the Russians are throwing everything they've got. This, you know, in Russia, as you guys know, there is no domestic dissent. There's no pressure on Russia to end the war. And Putin has made clear he will accept whatever casualties it takes to get what he wants. And if you are the smaller country, you really can't afford to be in a war of attrition. The good news is, well, I'm going to say the good news is the Ukrainians have killed more Russians, and some people would find that a little, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be rooting for people to die. Let's just say, like, from the perspective of the Ukrainians, the good news is the Ukrainians have killed more Russians than the Russians have killed Ukrainians, but the Ukrainian army is smaller, and thus they can't afford to lose that many guys. I've taken two trips to Ukraine. The first was in late August of last year. This most recent one ended in mid-March. The first trip was like a week and a couple of days. This last one was closer to 2 weeks. And I knew the mood was going to be different on this second trip. That first trip out there, the Prigozhin coup in Russia had occurred, and there was, even though it was only a coup that lasted for about a day, there had been this sense of like, oh, maybe Russia's a little less stable. Maybe Putin's got to sleep with one eye open. You know, there was a question of maybe the Russian resolve was faltering. I think we can now say from the perspective of April 2024, we really can't count on that. We're going to be dealing with Russia until he dies. I mean, we're going to be dealing with Putin until he dies in his sleep, hopefully with a pillow over his face. But we can't count on that. So in this last trip, I spoke to a defense expert and I was like, so how's the war going? And he said, it's been a very Russian war. And by that he means it started for the Russians catastrophically badly. Nothing worked at the start. The army wasn't coordinating with the Air Force. The Air Force wasn't coordinating with the Navy. Nobody was briefed correctly. There were troops who thought they were going on a training mission, troops who thought that this was, remember, they were supposed to wrap this up in 3 days. And here we are in 2 years and two, 3 months or so. Apparently some of the airborne soldiers, instead of being given an updated map of Ukraine, were sent in with Soviet roadmaps from the 1970s. And according to the History Museum of Kyiv, they have this whole display on this. So they, you know, there's, apparently Russians were landing and interrogating the locals. Where's the forest? The map says there's a forest. They turned it into suburbia 2 decades ago, man. The Russians were not going in with perfect intelligence. But what this analyst was telling me is that the Russians reverted to what they do best, which is hammering everything with artillery and their willingness to bear unimaginable human sacrifices and that. Human meat waves was the term he used. I probably should have given you a trigger warning before that. This analyst, by the way, the analyst's name is Kyle Orton, and no, it's not the old quarterback for the Bears. He said that the Russians cannot, he doesn't think the Russians will ever succeed in taking Kyiv, the capital city. mostly because urban fighting is absolutely hellacious, all kinds of blind alleys and ambush points and all that kind of stuff. But he did see, and this is conversations in early to mid-March, that the Russians could probably grind down Ukraine to forcing them to accept a peace deal that would really be unacceptable. Now, I keep running into people who are like, why can't Zelensky be reasonable and why can't they just sit down and talk it out? Like the Ukrainians being invaded are the ones who are being unreasonable or something like that. First of all, I should point out, there is no appetite for a deal. Every Ukrainian I've spoken to on both trips basically are like, we are going to kick these bastards out of our country. We're not giving up one inch. Okay, they use the metric system. We're not going to give up one centimeter. Again, minor trigger warning. What the Russians did in the parts of Ukraine that they occupied in the opening months of the war was horrific. And so the Ukrainians see the Russians as the guys who assaulted their grandmothers, their mothers, their wives, their daughters, their granddaughters. They are not in any mood to sit down and say, here's the territory you get to keep, you know, for what you've done so far. Secondly, the only peace deal, now we haven't seen the actual text of it, but the Wall Street Journal got their hands on, were able to read it and then kind of summarize it. Basically, the peace deal for Russia is, you guys give up your army, and we promise we won't invade anymore. Now, I know Vladimir Putin looks like a really trustworthy guy, you know, KGB colonels are famous for their integrity. So the whole thing was basically, we're gonna disarm you, and trust us, we won't invade you for the third time. The other thing is, if you talk to any Ukrainian, they'll be quick to point out the war did not begin in February 2022. That's when we perceive it as the full-scale invasion. But Russia basically went into those eastern provinces, they call them oblasts out there, the Donetsk and the Luhansk. My pronunciation is terrible. You'd think I would know more at this point. Basically they've been fighting a kind of guerrilla war with what they call the Little Green Men. They're basically Russian soldiers, they just don't have any insignias on their uniforms. The Ukrainians are like, why should we give up anything to these people? Why should we give up, why should we sit down and make concessions? They're the ones who started this war, they're the ones who are attacking us. I should point out, when I was over there in March, there was no sense of when the House was going to pass the recent aid package. I'm very happy that the U.S. did that. Kudos to everybody who did it. Kudos to Mike Johnson. I take back everything I was saying about him like 2-3 weeks ago. This should help the Ukrainians. Europe has kind of picked up the slack in that absence. Now, I know that, this is National Review. One of my distinguished previous colleagues, Jonah Goldberg, famously called the French cheese-eating surrender monkeys, quoting the Simpsons. But Europe has actually done a pretty good job of carrying their weight on this. And some of it's how you measure it. If you add up the humanitarian aid, the financial aid, and the military aid, Europe has actually done more than the U.S. We've done most of the military aid. But on the other hand, we have the biggest military. I'm not going to spend a lot of time getting angry at Denmark for not sending more, tanks and weapons. And ironically, Denmark said just a couple of weeks ago, you guys need artillery shells? We're sending you everything we've got left. Maybe this is the time to invade Denmark. I don't know. But this is just kind of this sense of there are certain countries, basically all the Eastern Europeans, the Baltic states, Poland, the ones who are closest to Russia, unsurprisingly, the ones who are next on the menu are very interested in helping Ukraine and making sure they don't lose this war. Germany's doing okay. They're talking a good game. They could do a little better. France is all right. Spain, Portugal, and Italy are just completely oblivious to the fact that there's a war going on and they should be helping. You're going to see also numbers that would say compare the U.S. to European Union, and I should also point out the European Union no longer includes the United Kingdom. It does not include Norway, and the Norwegians have been pretty good at help with this, and it doesn't include the Swiss. I don't think the Swiss have sent anything in military aid, but they have sent financial and humanitarian aid. So, the other night I was at a restaurant, and the waiter asked if anyone had ever told me I look like the film director Christopher Nolan. The answer is no, but I responded by telling him this long, elaborate, fascinating story completely out of sequential order. The Christopher Nolan fans in the audience just got that. So I'm going to jump around a bit between the two trips, and if that's that, it's just the Christopher Nolan in me coming out. I have reported from all these other places. I did leave in Turkey, but I have not reported from war zones until last year. I am not Arthur Kent Scud Stud, and I'm not a war correspondent. And I have a longtime friend and reader who at the start of the war in the Russian invasion in February 2022, was like, I gotta do something to help these people. And James is crazy, but he's the best kind of crazy, because he got together a bunch of friends and he said, all right, what can we do to help these people? And he found a guy, a friend who had basically a big station wagon, and they decided to start running trips. Not every, he has a day job, he's a lawyer, but he's like, I'm gonna go over there and I'm gonna load up on diapers and first aid kits and blankets and anything that refugees would need. We're gonna gather all this stuff in southern Poland, drive across the border, and then stay overnight in western Ukraine, where things are relatively peaceful. I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. And we're gonna drive to eastern Ukraine, drop them off, and then come back. And I'm like, okay, eastern Ukraine, that's where they're doing all the bombing. That's, you know, and he's like, yeah, well, my friend James, he's becoming a US citizen, but he's British. And he's like, well, you know, it's really not that bad. The Russians are very precise about when they bomb. They mostly do it in the mornings and the evenings. Mostly in the mornings and the evenings. Have any of you seen the movie, The Hunt for Red October? Late Senator Fred Thompson says, son, Russians don't take a dump without a plan. Apparently that really is true. Apparently they really don't bomb in mid-afternoon. I don't know if they're having tea or something, but you know, James had gotten through this. And so I'd written something about Ukraine and he said, you know, the next time you're out there, you should come with me. And I came up with every conceivable excuse about, and James is like, Jim, there are not going to be any Russian snipers shooting at you. You're going to be in the west side of the country. Everything's going to be safe. Everything's going to be safe. This is what you could call ominous foreshadowing. And I thought about it. I'm like, okay, there are some things in life you should see with your own eyes. I've been writing about the Russian invasion. I should go out there and I should try to see it myself. And he said, not only was there no risk or where we're going to be, that there would be no running. Because, I'm just going to shock you, but I don't like running. So the first trip to Ukraine, like I said, we were there for about a week. We went across the border, went up to a small city called Kobyl. It's close to the Belarusian border. Technically, it's far from the front, but they've been worried about Russian forces coming down south through from Belarus the entire time. They had the power plant attacked. But it's really considered one of the safer ones. But worth noting, they had, at that time, this is August, 47 young men who had already died in the war. And so this is a city about the size of Oshkosh, Wisconsin. This is not, this is not Kansas City, this is not New York City, this is not a big... So to give you a sense, like, they are paying a terrible price. But they heard the call. We go there, spend about a week in Kyiv, the capital, then we went down to Odessa. That city was by far the most tense on that first trip. It's on the Black Sea. It's a beach resort city. It's beautiful. When we went there, we were there for a day. There's a beach, kids are playing, you have the fancy hotels, swimming pools. People were having, it was late summer, there's a really nice day. But it was almost like a Twilight Zone episode, because I want you to picture a Miami or some sort of beach resort. There was not a single boat in the water in any direction, not even a rowboat. And that's because there are Russian mines out there. There are Russian submarines out there. That city was tense. The saying was the front begins at the water's edge. And at any given moment, their sense was the Russians could start trying to fight their way up ashore. Anybody ever hear of the Potemkin Steps? Battleship Potemkin. All right, I brought up this anecdote just for you, sir. So it's kind of one of the famous landmarks, and my hotel was not too far from it. James was sleeping late, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check this out for myself. I'm a competent grown man. I can walk around a city at war and not run into any trouble. Well, it turns so the top of the Potemkin steps, there's these little pillbox and sandbags and barbed wire and all kinds of stuff like that. So I'm like, okay, clearly I can't go over there, but maybe I can see it from the bottom. I walk down a parallel street, go down, make the turn, walk by the waterfront. They have all kinds of lovely displays talking about the history of the Potemkin Steps. And I take out this phone, and I start taking pictures. And a firm but polite Ukrainian soldier with a very big gun starts approaching me and says, you're not allowed to be here. You're not allowed to take these pictures. Who are you? What are you doing here? I show him my passport. All right, so you're an American. You're not one of the bad guys. Polite but firm is the way I would say this guy who made me look small. So again, just kind of, there's great tension there, particularly in Odessa. But I would point out, like, the entire trip, I'd say we probably had 13 or 14 air raid sirens. And the first one, I'm kind of freaking out. You know, all right, I know this is, you know, are we supposed to go somewhere or something? I cannot emphasize enough that, particularly during the daytime, the Ukrainians treat the air raid sirens the way jaded New Yorkers treat a car alarm going off down the street. They've heard it all, no big deal. We were eating in a very fine restaurant, talking with James, and I hear this. Is that an air raid siren? Yes, yes it is. And nobody in the restaurant jumps up. Nobody in the restaurant's there. They're all sitting, dining, and all stuff. And the way to think about it is that, like, imagine if your workplace had a fire alarm 6 or 7 times a day. You'd tune it out. You'd just get used to it. Now, some days they have no air raid alarms. But in one of the nights we were there, they had like 4 or 5 in a row. And after a while, you stop reacting to it. You can't run to, you know, you have to just decide, you know what, I'm going to stay in bed, or I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. It is kind of just bizarre to think about all the different ways and times you can have your life interrupted like that. In Lviv, this most recent trip, I spoke to a young woman named Halya, who was, decided she wanted to help more with the war effort. She never learned how to drive a car. She's like, I need to learn how to drive. So she takes the class, she's taking her driving test, and a Russian drone flies over during her driver's test. The rest of the thing, I was like, oh, how'd you do? And she said that the rest of the test was canceled, which is good, because I'd hate to think, you know, you failed to use a turn signal because the Russian drone was coming. So on my first trip, I had lots of alerts, but I didn't really see or hear anything that felt particularly dangerous. Now, when people said, oh, how was the second trip to Ukraine? I'll say, oh, that was 99% safe, which is not 100% safe, and it's that last 1% that will get you. And again, I've emphasized, I don't do this sort of thing. I have good friends who worried about me going over there. I have 2 teenagers, thank you for your prayers. My younger teenager was nervous about this. My wife is fine. My wife is like, you'll be fine. My father-in-law, Jim, I will not get, I should also point out, my wife was actually born in Kyiv. She came over when she was 5. And I should also point out that my in-laws are Ukrainian Jews, which means they certainly aren't pro-Russian, but they don't have warm, fuzzy memories of how the Ukrainians treated them. And my in-laws came over in 1980, became Americans, and they really haven't looked back. They've never been back to the old country. They don't have any yearning to go back. So I sometimes joke that I'm the first member of the family to go back to Kyiv. But they were fine. My brother thought I was crazy. So people were nervous. And I'm like, you know, there's nothing to worry about. In fact, the night before we were going to drive out of the country down through Moldova. There are no flights into Ukraine, as you probably would imagine. So you have to drive across the border. I actually got to talk to my younger son. And I said, look, it's been fine. It's been quiet. Nothing to worry about. Dad's coming home hunky-dory. Don't make those promises. So that final night, around 3 a.m., the hotel's public address system announced, first in Ukrainian and then in English, the city is under air raid. I should point out, when you check into this hotel, they make you sign a waiver that they have a shelter. It's basically the parking garage across, adjacent across the street. And they say you should go when you hear an air raid siren. And I guess if something happens, I can't sue them if I don't go to the air raid siren. I think I'll have bigger problems if I get hit. But anyway, 3 a.m., we get this call, and as I'd like to say, I'm not afraid. No, I was lazy, and I simply didn't want to get out of bed. And so I roll over, go back to sleep. 5 a.m., boom. I just realized this microphone isn't working. Boom. it sounds like thunder, but I know it's not thunder. And there's kind of this orange flash in my hotel window. And I'm like, the war has arrived. But I don't hear any sirens. I don't hear any shouting or screaming on the street or anything like that. I go to the window, and there's no signs of any commotion out there. And I'm like, God, did I dream that? An hour later, the hotel intercom tells us the all clear signal. I check my cell phone. That night, my last night in Kyiv, the Russians launched the largest air attack in Kyiv in 6 weeks. 31 missiles launched at the city, 29 cruise, 2 ballistic missiles. And if ballistic missiles sound scary, it's because they are. A couple of days earlier, a Russian ballistic missile had hit in Odessa, killed 20 people, injured 70. Basically, they can level a building or almost a city block. And so what I'd heard was one of the U.S.-provided Patriot missiles shooting down one of the incoming ones over my neighborhood of Podol. Allegedly, debris had come down. I went around the next morning. I couldn't find any. But so when people say, do you think we should keep sending Patriot missiles to Ukraine? Yes. Yes, I do. The thing I can't emphasize enough is, unfortunately, this war is going to go on for a while. There is no point where, there's no indication Putin sees any need to go to the negotiating table. Maybe if the next 6 months to a year go badly, his attitude will change, but I wouldn't necessarily count on that. And the Ukrainians, as I've emphasized, do not feel any desire to negotiate. The first trip up by Kobol, I spoke to a former Ukrainian soldier who was training the civilian defense units. He spent his whole career in the U.S. In the Ukrainian military. He'd actually come over here and trained at Fort Hood twice. And he goes by the nickname Wolf. And so I asked him, how long do you think the war is going to last? And he said, 3 or 4 years. It's history, World War II, Stalin, Putin. It doesn't matter how many dead people there are, Putin will not stop. He could lose 5 million or 10 million, he will not stop. Look what happened in Chechnya. And I got to emphasize, this was not him saying this with fear or with dread. It was just kind of matter of fact of, this is what the Russian history indicates, that they don't quit wars and this is what's going to go on. This most recent trip, before I went to Ukraine, I met up in London with a guy named David Knowles. He runs the Ukraine the Latest podcast for the Daily Telegraph paper out there. It's a very good podcast. 2 or 3 times a week, they just walk through everything that's happened there. So I'm like, so how's, I know things are going bad, how's it going? And he says, he mentioned the source had said to him, even if the US and Europe gave us all the shells, all the tanks we need, what you cannot give and nobody else can give is manpower. And that is a serious problem. Now, after I returned, the Ukrainian government lowered its draft age from 27 to 25. Now, to American ears, that sounds really weird. We are used to, in the Vietnam War, people being drafted at 18, and even today, you register for selective service at age 18. There's a Ukrainian reasoning behind this. I don't know if it's the right reasoning, but there's a logic to them. That basically the idea is the older brothers will go off and fight the war, and the younger brothers will be left to rebuild the country after the war. I also think that by age 27, kind of the expectation is that by that point you've gotten married, you've probably had some kids, and that means that there's going to be another generation of Ukrainians coming up behind you. I should also note the conscription of Ukraine. If you think they're skimping on their conscription, the conscription of Ukrainian men goes up to age 60. Some of you in here are like, whew, I just made it. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier on the front line is 43. Every Ukrainian I spoke to is they welcome donations of just about everything, but you know what they really want? Ibuprofen, aspirin. There are a lot of Ukrainian soldiers who are middle-aged and have sore backs. At this point, it was not clear U.S. aid was going to come. The forecast was they're holding on by their fingernails. At some point, they're going to have a strategic retreat, probably very gradually. They're still going to keep inflicting, significant casualties on the Russians, but the expectation of Knowles was that the Dnipro is this river that kind of goes down the middle of the country, and that the Ukrainians would have to basically withdraw to the western half. That was pre-U.S. aid coming along, which may kind of alter the calculations a little bit. But when I was in Kyiv, I got to speak to probably one of my favorite sources. His name is Marian Zablotsky. He's a member of the Ukrainian Parliament. Before that, he was a member of the SBU, which is basically the Ukrainian FBI with some touches of the CIA. By the way, I don't like the idea of law enforcement and intelligence gathering being in the same institution. Yeah. Kind of ironic if you've read the Dangerous Click novels, which is all about them basically operating completely together. But as a Constitution fan, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. But anyway, the point is, this guy's really well connected. He knows the score of what's going on. And I said, so how's it going? And he's like, without U.S. weapons, we have obviously started to lose. And even if this is not reflected in the areas lost in terms of territory, it is obvious that losses are accumulating. Even if you look at publicly available data, sometimes we lose several tanks a day, probably dozens killed every day. Now, I asked Zablotsky, how's the morale of the Ukrainian forces in the field? And he gave me maybe my favorite quote of the entire trip. It's relatively simple. Of course, many people are tired. But when you get to shoot back, the morale is higher. Alas, for a good chunk of the last couple months, the Ukrainians have had one or two shells for every 10 shells the Russians shoot at them. Very tough, never mind to win a war, very tough to hold your ground even under circumstances like that. So on this most recent trip, I've been able to meet two leaders of two groups of foreign fighters that are helping the Ukrainians. The first was Ahmed Zakayev, the prime minister of the Chechen government in exile, or as James calls them, the good Chechens. Because you probably have heard about the bad Chechens. If you're not up on Chechen history, as I was not until like a day before this meeting, there were two Chechen wars. The first one is in the mid-90s, and from our point of view, the good Chechens won. And then the bad Chechens, backed by the Russians, won. The second one was fought in 1999-2000, very important, the rise of Vladimir Putin. They installed Ramzan Kadyrov, who's very pro-Putin and every bit the brute you'd probably think. So when the Russians invaded Ukraine, Zakayev, the leader of the good Chechens, announced the formation of the Chechen Volunteer Battalion, fighting alongside the Ukrainians. They specialize in raids across the border in the Russian provinces or oblasts of Belgorod and Kursk. It's the only way we'll get the war over, Zakayev told me. And he speaks some English. We were traveling with another friend who spoke Russian, or once again thought they spoke Russian. I brought really good charade skills to the table. So between that, we were able to get this across. Russians absolutely have to understand that it's going to involve attacks on their own soil. They have to feel this war in order to stop this war. The Russians love to fight wars on other people's soil. The Chechen Volunteer Battalion is aiming to recruit 10,000 fighters. They are below that number. He would not say how far below. They basically recruit out of Chechnya. They recruit out of the Chechen expat communities in Europe. And they do not have, apparently there are not significant Chechen communities in the US, or if they're recruiting from the US, they didn't want to tell me. This guy is, he led one of the tank columns in the taking of Grozny, the Chechen capital, in the first war. And ironically, he was one of the more optimistic assessments. And he said to me, I understand the minds of the Ukrainians. They have no choice. They have to resist this aggression. They will win because they have to win. So in addition to the Chechen fighters, the Ukrainians are aided by the Freedom of Russia Legion, a group of Russians who are fighting alongside the Ukrainians against the Russian army. They are led, or at least the political leader, is a guy named Ilya Ponomarev, and he describes them as the opposition as the Putinist army. Ponomarev is a former member of the Duma, the Russian parliament, and he was the only lawmaker to vote against the annexation of Crimea in 2014. The following year, he gets charged with embezzlement. He says this is entirely organized by Putin as retaliation. I can't say it's not the sort of thing Putin wouldn't do. So after that, he basically has to live in exile. He fled the country and is now the head of this political head of the Freedom of Russia Legion. By the way, again, I usually cover domestic politics. I usually meeting people out of Capitol Hill. It's kind of boring. I had more meetings with people Vladimir Putin wanted to kill on this last trip. And let me tell you, when you're in that situation, you're very careful about whose water glass is who. And you're okay. Are we sitting near the window? Should I, these guys travel with security. Everything turned out okay. But so I asked him how the war is going. And Ponomarev is like, well, the bad thing is that it's still going. This should have been done over a long time ago. The whole thing with supplying weapons in such small portions allows the Putinist army to adapt. Now I'm going to segue from my prepared remarks here. So Vladimir Putin has a favorite philosopher named Alexander Dugin. And Dugin has been calling for the invasion and annexation of Ukraine for a long time. Basically, this is Russia's destiny. We are the leaders of the world, blah, 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 yeah. So in 2023, about a year after the war began, Dugin gives this big speech in Moscow, big rally. And afterwards, his car blows up. But he wasn't in it, his daughter was. Now, to hear the Ukrainians, and admittedly, these are not objective sources, to hear the Ukrainians and these exiled Russians say it, the daughter is every bit as bad as the father is and had it coming, despite my Irish heritage, I'm not a big car bomb fan. Either the drink or the tool. And Ponomarev at least said he did not have a hand in that use of that car bomb. He just knows who did and was helping pass along the message. But again, he didn't do it, and neither did OJ. So Anyway, so Ponomarev's viewpoint is this war will never end with the liberation of Ukrainian territory. It will end only in Moscow. The origin of the problem is with Putin, and so until you remove Putin and destroy Putinism, the war will continue. That's what we need to focus on, and that's why I'm doing this stuff with the Russian Legion. Oh, by the way, you remember that theater attack in Moscow? I talked to this guy like 3 days before, and I was like, oh God, please don't let it be the guy I was talking to. Please don't let it be the guy I was talking to. Far as we know, that was ISIS, and this has nothing to do with this guy. But Ponomarev's perspective is that the U.S. is basically doing everything possible to prevent the Ukrainians from winning the war, that Ukraine should not attack Russian territory, that they should not use U.S. or other NATO equipment on attacks against Russian targets in Russian territory, and probably, as you may have heard, the U.S. has told the Ukrainians, stop bombing Russian oil refineries and other parts of their energy infrastructure. Now, because this might bring up oil prices, and well, we can't have high gas prices in an election year. That's bad. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin told the Senate Armed Services Committee, certainly those attacks on infrastructure and oil refineries and such could have a knock-on effect in terms of the global energy situation, but quite frankly, I think Ukraine is better served going after tactical and operational targets that can directly influence the current fight. Now, Lloyd Austin knows more about military than I'm ever going to know, but what do the Russian tanks run on? What makes the jets fly and the helicopter? Is all that stuff run on fuel, oil, gas? Like, if you blow up all the refineries, the Russians have less of that, and then the Russian forces can't fly around. It seems like there's a logic there, but there's kind of this negative, it does seem like there's this recurring pattern of the Biden administration saying to the Ukrainians, we will do anything it takes to help you win. Oh, no, don't do it that way. No, no, not that way. That's a bad way to win the war. Don't do that. Yeah. My last full day in Ukraine involved a visit to a secret drone production facility. It is so secret, I can't tell you where it is. Also convenient for the Ukrainians, I couldn't give you directions if I wanted to. I can tell you that it looks like just another factory. There's nothing unique or special about this. I do think the Russians may have some idea that this facility is important. I don't know if they know exactly the details. At some point in the past, they fired a very big missile at this site. And we were being showed around by this guy named Greg Pavlov. He was the head of operations for building ground drones. You've all seen the flying ones. These are ones that usually have four wheels, and they're basically like a giant remote control car, except they can do all kinds of really cool things and work in extremely difficult environments. So the day they were attacked, apparently they get this, like, everybody in Ukraine has the app that says you're under air alert. And I should point out, one of the reasons the Ukrainians are a little blasé about it is that when they set off an air raid, they do it over the entire oblast or province, and that can be like the size of New Jersey. So even though there's an air raid alert going off, it could be many miles from where you are, which I think is one of the reasons they kind of, you know, they're not too worried about it. If you're at a military base or apparently an important site like this one, they give you something better. And he said, kind of picture FlightAware. Have you ever seen that site, you know, showing you where the planes are flying? Apparently it's like that, except you can watch the missile getting closer to where you are. And they're basically saying, like, yeah, when we get the warning, it's about 2 minutes. That's not enough time for everybody to get to the shelter. So nobody, everybody just keeps working. Which, like, you know, he literally said, all the people who are working here, they understand this could be their last day. Now, Keith Olbermann had famously said, when talking about an injury to a baseball player, he's listed as day-to-day, but then again, aren't we all? But I do think about, like, you know, you think about soldiers on the front line, you think about the people who are you know, in likely target areas. You could be an engineer helping build drones, and at any given moment, some missile could come in, and that's the end of your day. So Pavlov is running the ground vehicle projects. These ground drones can carry loads, they can deploy mines, and for one model, they can actually carry a wounded individual. So apparently, for the Russian drone operators, if they see four guys carrying a fifth guy on a stretcher, that's a worthwhile target. Go shoot that one. If you have one or two guys, it's not worthwhile. It's considered not a cost-effective use of their ammunition or you know, suicide drone. So if you can get a drone that can go out there and get the injured guy onto the stretcher and do that, you have a much, you know, that could end up saving people's lives. The Ukrainian, I have a lot of notes on this, and I'll just give the short version. At the start of the war, the Ukrainian government said to every company that's involved in the defense industry, you all play for the same team now. You all trade information, there are no different companies, there are no different profits. Everybody's working together. If one guy has an innovation on batteries, you tell it to everybody else and all that kind of stuff. So the engineers actually love it. This is like, if you ever want to be told, the job comes first, don't worry about secrecy, don't worry about confidential information, don't worry about what if the opposition, the competition, everybody's on the same team. And you know, what comes out of this factory like is a matter of life and death. Pavlov did tell me a lot of fascinating stuff about the aerial drones. Basically, they're just buying a lot of the basic airframes from China, and then they upgrade the batteries, the cameras, all the components that go into it. And apparently, like within like a week of the war starting, they were taking like the stuff people use for fun, just for flying around. They'd figured out how to put a little like hand or you know, claw type holder on it, putting a grenade in there, and figuring out how to drop grenades on the Russians. Again, MacGyver would be proud. The other thing that's kind of fascinating is that the supply chains issues for this, because obviously they want to get their hands on as much of this stuff as possible. They have no import restrictions from China. But apparently what Pavlov was telling me is like, oh, you know, he'd call up a company in China and say, you guys have really good cameras. Can we buy 2,000 of them from you this year? And the answer would say, sorry, the Russians have prepaid all of our contracts for the next 2 years. Must be nice to have all that oil and gas money that Russia is still getting because China and India are still buying their gas and oil. And even if the Ukrainians have a contract with like $1,000 a device, the Russians will come along to those contractors and say, we'll pay you $3,000 a device just to cut the contract. So they kind of have to keep their supply chain secret. Because if the Russians figure out who's supplying them, they'll either outbid them or potentially strong-arm them into stop doing that and to stop paying them. The other thing which is absolutely fascinating is just the back and forth cat and mouse with jamming devices. Our first trip when we went down to Odessa, we were at a volunteer center where they'd raised money for anti-drone guns. And these look like something out of Star Wars. They do not look like real guns. And what they do is they actually emit a pulse or a beam that interrupts the signal from the Russian drone, and usually just drops right down. And what the Ukrainians will then try to do is get the drone. You can sometimes get useful intelligence. You can see where it was flying and what it's seen and stuff like that. And at this volunteer center, it was mostly older women. So just, I want you to picture little babushkas with all of these Star Wars rifles, pretending to shoot them out of the sky. There were a lot of times on these trips where I'm like, am I dreaming? So I saw that in the first trip, and at this drone factory. What's fascinating is that the stuff that worked, like within 3 months, it'll be obsolete, because the Russians will figure out some way to change their frequencies and stuff, and then the Ukrainians will have to find new ways to get their jamming stuff. And he was describing, they've seen videos of Ukrainian soldiers with their device. Sometimes it's a gun, sometimes it's like a wand or something. And they see the Russian drone coming and they're waving it at it and it doesn't work anymore. And you see the Russian drone fire the missile, kill the guy. I think I can talk about this. Nothing like talking to a guy who's like, this is really fascinating, stuff your readers would love. If you report that, people will die, so don't do that. But so basically, I guess one of the early antennas that they had for these sorts of things sent it out in a way that was like 90%. And eventually the Russians figured out if you were like, if you came up really high, you could basically go over it and then lower back down and drop it on them. So you know, imagine thinking you've got some protection against Russian drones and then it suddenly doesn't work. So the microphones are being set up, which is a sign that I should start wrapping up my prepared remarks. I don't know if the Ukrainians are going to win the war, but on both of these trips I've come away, they're just never going to quit. And ironically, on the first trip, my sense was if the U.S. ever said, that's it, we're not sending any more weapons, you're on your own, they would just take whatever they can get from the Europeans, they would take whatever they can get from the black market. By the way, the Czech Republic, all those years of being a not quite shady, but let's say not clean-handed arms dealer came in very handy, because everybody is in NATO like, well, can we provide these weapons? How do we have it in our stockpiles? And the Czechs were like, hey, this world is full of artillery shells. Let's just go to these people and say, hey, we'd like you to lose some of your artillery shells. And you're going to find some money that we just happened to leave there. And there's not going to be any paper trail, and there's going to be no way for the Russians to know that you helped the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians will get a whole bunch of shells. So there are a whole bunch of countries that are apparently being paid by the Czechs to turn over some of their shells and getting some of them to that. And a bunch of our NATO allies also have contributed money to this. So, hey, it's good to, good to have some Czech arms dealers around. You never know when they come in handy. But the sense, I spared you the tales of Bucha and the mass graves. They're just, I have pictures on my phone that nobody should look at. But these people, Bucha was the suburb where everything went wrong, and the Russians occupied, and the Russians killed basically anybody they wanted to for any old reason. Not the most disciplined troops. Irpin was a suburb next to it where they effectively fought them off, and basically they was like, come to City Hall, get your rifle, good luck. And the citizens did that, and they created enough, they managed to repel them. The Ukrainians, if they have to use sticks and stones, they will do that against the Russians. And I just kind of think, if some foreign force had ever come along and invaded and occupied 20% of America and looted and raped and pillaged and executed religious leaders, would we want to sit down and negotiate, how much they get to keep? I don't think so. And I think that American spirit of to hell with you, this country was founded by people willing to shoot people in the head over the taxes on tea. We would never accept anybody else coming along and telling us how things have got to be. That's the way the Ukrainians feel. And conceivably, they might feel differently someday. In Noel's conversation, he did acknowledge, and I kind of got one or two comments like this from the Ukrainians I spoke to. They'll acknowledge that what's left in eastern Ukraine, like, that's no man's land. They've had cities that are leveled. They've had, infrastructure's gone. And there are people who say, well, not everybody who wanted to get out has gotten out, but at some point, everybody who wants to get out will get out. Are there people who are okay with the Russians taking over? Yes, but a lot fewer than the Russians expected. Are there people who might well be exhausted of war and willing to accept being ruled by Russians? Conceivably. Back when I was living in Turkey, I had a friend who worked somewhere in the US government in the Balkans. And this was 2005 to 2007, so the Balkan Wars were over, but it was not that long ago. And I was like, boy, that place must be a powder keg. And my buddy was like, no, they've all lost too much. They're tired. And so maybe that day will come for the Ukrainians and the Russians, but it's not coming anytime soon. And so, and just finally one last note. I'm glad President Biden has said whatever it takes. I would like him to be followed up with action. The good news is we've sent the Ukrainians Patriot missile batteries. We've sent them ATACMS long-range missiles. We've sent them Abrams tanks. Apparently, there's talk about giving them even longer-range weapons. Problem is, we keep giving them to the Ukrainians like a year after they ask for them, and the Ukrainians are kind of like, this is great. It would have been really great to have this a year ago before all these people died. But and also, I think, like, at some point, you're going to have to hit targets on Russian soil. I do not understand this. We want you to win the war, but in a nice way. In a way that leaves Vladimir Putin feeling good about himself. I really don't think that's an option. And I'm just kind of reminded, in Afghanistan, the U.S. trained the Afghan army to win battles with air support. And then one day we said, hey, we're not doing air support anymore. Good luck. Good luck against the Taliban. And we saw how that happened. And for about a year and a half, the U.S. outfitted the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians inflicted massive casualties on the Russians. And then, we just stopped for a while. We've begun again. Hopefully things will turn out better, and that is the conclusion of my prepared remarks. I know it has not been a laugh riot, but you've been a terrific and attentive audience. There are microphones here. I'll happily answer as many questions as possible. I would ask that you not do the, I have a four-part question in the form of a long, meandering monologue. So as the least pithy man on television used to say, keep it pithy. So anyway, thank you very much for listening, everyone. You got there first.
Yeah, I was really, I think Putin's a psychopath. The Russians are bad. The Ukrainians are good. and we should support them. Mm-hmm. There is one thing, though, that I could offer as perhaps something you could give Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, we wouldn't care for it if Canada decided to join the Warsaw Pact in this Cold War. We wouldn't have cared for that. Even if the Canadians wanted to do it, we probably wouldn't care for that. So that's a segue into my question. Would it not be the one thing we could give Russia is that Ukraine will not, in the near future, join NATO?
Join NATO? I think the problem is, if they'd had that conversation in January 2022, before the war started, then you might, I think one of them would be more acceptable to the Ukrainians. The problem is that the Ukrainians want to get in NATO ASAP. And I guess the other thing is, like, whenever, the problem we have is that whenever, like, let's say they announce a ceasefire tomorrow, they're not going to do it, but, like, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, the Russian army rebuilds up and they simply could reinvade again. And so the Ukrainians, the moment there's a stop, they're going to say, you know, there's, you know, the standard entry into NATO, there's the accelerated, the Ukrainians are going to want the drive through. They're going to want to get in there as quickly as possible, because to them, like, let's say, we notice Putin has not invaded the Baltics. Putin has not invaded, you know, Poland. That to them is their guarantee. And it's going to be very, without that, I don't think the Ukrainians will feel like they have any guarantee, because it would all be about the, you know, the well-meaning of either Russia or whoever his successor is. And honestly, there's not much reason to think his successor is going to be that much nicer. So,
but if you give your enemy one thing, and see what he does with it.
If I thought that would work, I could see the argument for trying that, but I wouldn't get my hopes up too high. Yeah. You got to the mic fast. Yeah.
On your trip, did you learn why it took a week for Zelensky to fire his generals, and what was that all about?
Yeah, all right, so...
And excuse me, but I noticed after that that this strategy seemed to be changing.
Yeah.
And was that because the generals would not execute the strategy?
So I'm going to, I'm going to tell you first general stuff on Zelensky, and then something I heard that I have, this is why you come to these events, you get to hear things I have not reported. One of the reasons I have not reported, is I haven't been able to verify it, and it's pretty wild and out there, but I will share it with you for usefulness. But the short thing is, there's a lot of critiques of Zelensky that are generally not the ones you hear. Zelensky was very slow to believe that the Russians were actually invading. Zelensky was kind of a dovish candidate compared to the other politicians in Ukraine. He really seemed to think that he could have a charm offensive and he could get Putin to see reason. It did not work out that way. So there's a bunch of criticisms of Zelensky that are not the ones you get, that you generally hear in US media. So one of the most interesting conversations I had with someone who was in the Ukrainian military and fairly high up, basically believed that there was a mole in a high-level position in the Ukrainian military. And there was a death of a fairly high-ranking person on the general staff. The story was that this person was had a pile of Christmas presents, and that there was a live grenade mixed in with the Christmas presents, and that the child of the son of this military official pulled the grenade. That's horrible. It's also a little weird and suspicious. What, do you keep a grenade with your Christmas presents? That, you know, that even for wartime, that seems kind of weird. The allegations of this person was that that's not what happened at all, that was a suicide by a guy who was the mole and knew that they were closing in on him. So, there were a bunch of reasons the counteroffensive did not work the way the Ukrainians hoped. Most notably, when the U.S. fights a war, we have air domination. We take over the skies. We bomb the hell out of anything that's in our way. We charge head, and you know, like, it's a lot easier once you've bombed the heck out of them. The Ukrainians didn't have that option. Now, to their credit, the Russians don't have air superiority either. And in fact, the Ukrainians have had a lot of success of, you know, shooting some very valuable and high, very expensive planes out of the sky. But by and large, there's an argument to say they should never have gone forward with the counteroffensive. And the perspective of this particular Ukrainian military official was that, look, remember it was supposed to be a spring counteroffensive? Then April turned to May turned into June. where's the counteroffensive? It turned into a summer counteroffensive, and I said I was over there in August and it had pretty much just gotten started. They couldn't do the counteroffensive the way you're supposed to do it with air support. The amount of landmines on the front is basically the areas about the size of New Jersey, and they showed videos of this. Like, the landmines are like this far apart. So you'd be lucky if you could walk through it, never mind drive a Jeep or a tank or something like that. So, you know, do the Ukrainians have mine clearing equipment? Yes, but not nearly. In other words, they didn't have everything in place to do it the right way. But if they hadn't launched a counteroffensive by mid to late summer of 2023, people would start saying, are you guys ever going to do a counteroffensive? And people might think that this was it. So what they did it halfway. And the perspective of this Ukrainian military official was that that was a terrible choice. That, you know, you could either throw everything you got into your counteroffensive and hope for the best, or you could wait until you have all your material. You take the public relations hit, you take the morale hit for this sense of when is the counteroffensive going to start. They did halfway in the middle, and apparently they had this mole. I don't know this and I can't verify this, but this is what this official was saying. And I did check it out. There is the story of the grenade and the Christmas presents is real, or at least that was reported out there, and it does sound a little suspicious. So it would kind of put some stuff into place. So that's my best sense of why there was change in leadership, is that the idea that they found out somebody was passing along all the plans for the counteroffensive. So.
Yeah, sure. If the Russians were 100% when the war, sorry, it's sure. A two-parter.
Yeah, I guess that's all right.
If
yeah.
The Russians were 100% when the war started, what are they now? Mm. Plus, remember how all the Russian young men were getting out of the country?
Yeah.
Is, you know, what does that look like now?
Yeah. So the number of casualties on the Ukrainian side is a state secret for them, not for us. But apparently a couple weeks, beginning of the year, Zelensky said 33,000. Now, for perspective, we lost 55,000 in the Vietnam War over a span of decades. So that's a lot. And I think they, you know, like, the good news is Ukraine had like one of the largest armies in Europe before the war. The way the Ukrainians fight their war is much more protective of the personnel. Even the Americans were like saying, you're being too cautious about this. And I kind of feel like it's easy to say in Washington, you guys should be taking bigger risks, you know? But the Russians, so the West, the US and UK estimates is the Russians have lost about 300,000. That's not dead, that's dead, missing in action, and injured. But the estimation is that they've probably had anywhere from 100 to 150,000 killed, which is like two or three Vietnams in like a 2 year and couple month range. So the injuries of the Russian side have been terrible. The problem for why you're not seeing any pressure against the Russians to end the war is they're not doing conscription from Moscow and St. Petersburg. The wealthy elites in Moscow don't really, the McDonald's closed, the Starbucks closed. That beyond that, they, you know, their lives are pretty much the same the way they are. Out in the hinterlands, out in, you know, as you guys know, Russia is massive. There are a lot of, like, joining the Russian military, if you don't get killed, and the odds are not great, but if you don't get killed, you come back with a military bonus where you can buy bottles of vodka for all your buddies in your village, and you can party for 6 weeks, and women, you know. Like, for a lot of these guys who are living in dirt-poor Russian villages, if you go to war and you don't die, it's the best thing that's ever going to happen to you. Everybody's going to love you as a hero. You've been out fighting the Nazis like Zelensky. You know how bad those Jewish Nazis are. You know, like, they're totally have digested the propaganda, but also, like, what else do they have in their little in their little villages and stuff? This is their glory. This is the greatest thing that, you know, is ever going to happen to them. So, I've always been kind of skeptical. Public diplomacy on the part of the U.S. is like well-meaning, but it very rarely actually changes minds on the ground. And I don't think that there's any U.S. tool in our arsenal to get the typical poor young Russian man for not believing the greatest thing I can do is fight on behalf of my country, and I'll go kick those Ukrainians' asses. So,
just real quick, we have a question over here, and then I think we have one more that we'll wrap up with. That somebody's been trying to get in over on the side.
Okay, sure, great. All right.
So this is a bit more of a domestic question. So
sure.
Writing for National Review and being in the news media industry and stuff like that, a lot of people on the conservative persuasion side of things, as well as like Republicans, mm-hmm. And the ones that claim that they're realists have mm-hmm. made a lot of the arguments that we shouldn't support Ukraine because of, you know, lack of mm-hmm. Open democratic practices and stuff like that, which there is to some extent, or some corruption ratings. So why is it that, like, sure. you know, a lot of the quote-unquote realist conservatives like J.D. Vance and one of our senators, Josh Hawley, why is it that they've all of a sudden started sounding like staff writers from the Weekly Standard and started arguing, you know, against Ukraine on that basis when they could take the Jean Kirkpatrick line and take that sort of realist approach to supporting Ukraine?
Yeah. So while I was over there, they were coming up on when they were supposed to have their presidential election. Previous year, I believe they were supposed to have had parliamentary elections. And immediately after the war started, Ukraine declared martial law. And the constitution of Ukraine is clear, you cannot have elections during martial law. There are also some giant logistical problems, like the fact that 20% of the country is occupied. And also the fact that, like, because the Russians will bomb any large gathering of people, polling places would be a very tempting target. And, you know, the idea of, you know, I ask questions of local officials in places like Irpin and could you guys have local elections? Could you have, you know, vote by mail or something? And the general sense is that just logistically, can you get ballots to the guys at the front? You know, there are a lot of logistical challenges for that. I do get the sense, because most of the members of parliament who I spoke to were not in Zelensky's party. So they had two things. One is that there's a little bit of chafing. There's a little bit of, we'd like to get back to normal domestic politics. We'd like to be able to. The other thing is that they all were very quick to say, we think Zelensky's doing a great job. We think he's done a great job of representing us on the world stage. He's still a very popular, you know, he's a wartime leader. Nobody wants to criticize the leader of the country at a time when the country is at war that badly. The other thing is, everyone in the opposition party is, if we held a presidential election today, Zelensky would get reelected. So they're not itching to have a presidential election that they know they would lose. One of the more interesting conversations I had with a newspaper editor out there who says he doesn't think, when the war ends, particularly if the war ends on terms favorably to Ukraine, he doesn't think Zelensky will run for election. He sees a man who is exhausted, and I think we can all see it in his face, and there's just kind of this recognition that, like, you know, Churchill got voted out right after winning World War II. You know, maybe once you've protected your country and fought out, go out on a high note. It's not going to get any better from that, you know. And so, you know, my suspicion is that Zelensky's political career will not go well for longer after there. As for Vance and all that stuff, I could knock around these people. If I use the term, how many people recognize the name Michael Brendan Doherty? He's one of my colleagues. I think really highly of Michael. He's a bright, sharp guy who we disagree on this vehemently, but I love him. And kind of like your cousin at Thanksgiving, you know, who's, you think is wrong about everything. But Michael, no, and I'll point out, Michael does not have the position he does because he loves Putin. He does not have this out of, you know, he genuinely believes this is not in our long-term interest, that Russia's always going to care about this more than we do, and thus we should wash our hands. And, you know, I've talked to these people. I've talked to people who have pulled bodies out of cars in Bucha. I've talked to people who have dug up the bodies from the mass graves. I can't tell them, sorry, you're on your own. But anyway, so like that, I would like to see J.D. Vance and Hawley. Go out there, talk to these people. And if you still feel that way, if you still feel like these people don't deserve the help, okay, great. But it'd be very much exaggerating to say I've been traumatized by anything, but like you go and you talk to somebody who's been through some of this stuff, it sticks with you. And I just kind of, you know, at the beginning of the war, the Wall Street Journal, I kept the front page, and it said something like, you know, Russia invades Ukraine, new battle for global supremacy begins. And it was just like, just saying that, like, I sometimes periodically marvel, like, this is the biggest land war in Europe since World War II. And I just kind of feel like, you know, one, if you've ever read about World War II, if you've done, you know, read history books, I recently saw Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which is not a documentary, just want to let you know. It is the first film I've seen that actually kills more Nazis on screen than died in the actual war. But like you'd figure if the biggest land war in Europe since World War II, like you'd think that'd be in our news every day. And President Biden can go like 2 weeks without mentioning it. I feel like there's this very weird disconnect. It feels more distant and the stakes of this are very high. I don't know for certain that Putin would then start rolling into the Baltics and Poland and all that stuff. Russian army's taking a lot of hard hits. But there's this something called salami tactics, which basically the gist is, we're not going to invade all of NATO, but if some of our troops look a little close to Lithuania, what's America going to do about it? If we go into if our troops go into places they're not supposed to, do Germans want to fight for that? Do French? The idea is that you don't launch war. Okay, I'm being told to wrap it up. War's bad. War is all hell. Help the Ukrainians. Thank you.